SiriusXM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday, race fans. Sirius 162. XM 207. Sports Zone online, $9.99. And at our website, not yet at the website, stevebick.com. Probably later today, getting the kind of a reorientation of the stream service. So, I think yesterday we got the archive went up at about 4 o'clock, all right? And probably even earlier today. So probably, I think tomorrow, stream service will be restored. Speaking of restoring service, the tote system. Let's see about the tote system restoring service. Quite a fascinating circumstance yesterday. Matt Hegarty is going to join us in about 12 minutes, to talk about what transpired, because there's obvious uncertainty, although it sure feels like it is a scenario with the flooding of some pools in far-flung locales. That includes Harness, and crazy. I mean, really, as Matt's headline on the story reads, large and suspicious. Yeah. This has happened in various sets of circumstances. Sometimes, and I'll let Matt flesh those out. I mean, he's got a long history of tracking these kinds of situations. But one thing that, of course, makes this even more pronounced, aside from the specifics of the wagers. I mean, there were wagers, I mean, that were completely out of whack. Hundreds of thousands. Pools, you know, that made absolutely no sense, including at Monticello and the Meadows in Pittsburgh. And Superfecta pools and a Pick 5 pool. This was wild. Finger Lakes, it was smattered all over. Churchill immediately put a hold on the distribution of a super high five play. That was in the fourth. This computer, you know, computer generation, and you would assume, and you know, haywire, I'll let Matt discuss it. I can tell you that I reached out in a few different directions. Matt was the first, to, you know, fully report on it. And, for goodness sakes, the various entities that might be tracking this. Specifically, I don't know if he wants me to quote him or not, but I did reach out to Curtis Linnell at TRPB, and he said TRPB doesn't have any authority on this, and there won't be any statement from them that it's an area that essentially the racetrack associations themselves and any regulatory agencies in the states that monitor along these lines. It's their arena. So we'll let Matt Hegarty flesh that out. Matt, very familiar with these kinds of circumstances over the years. Seems more pronounced given, you know, the volatility of internet protocols and so forth. So and hacking and whatnot. I mean, this is, you know, this is obviously access to pools that and batch wagering, and whether it's a, you know, whether it's a mistake or somebody made some suggestions about what AI influence might do to these kinds of systems too. So we'll let Matt. I'll turn it over to him. Give you a rundown because we got a busy morning. Chris Block, who could not join us yesterday, after you know we had that pair of tributes to Bob Lothenbeck, and so we'll get Chris's appreciation in this hour. As if being, you know, I were speculating that at, you know, 68 was the initial number that was suggested, and not that, you know, is any better than what it turns out to be. Bob Lothenbeck was 64. I turned 64 on Monday. I mean, this and Sid and I were kind of as a post show. You know, reaction and as the, you know, word spread of Bob Lothenbeck's passing. I mean, this is a monumental, as much as Neil Pessin, you just were listening to the replay, as much as Neil Pessin's appreciation cited it and Sid's, this is a monumental loss. And I mean, to think at the age of 64, I mean, Bob Lothenbeck had decades of, you know, activity in the game, and particularly, you know, the venues, the Mid-American venues that he has competed, the, you know, as I mentioned yesterday, the, you know, the importance to Canterbury's program and, you know, Minnesota racing and breeding. And this is really heartbreaking. And you just probably heard minutes ago, Neil suggests that he did not sense necessarily that, you know, the family will go on with it. So Chris Block later in this hour. Gary Palmisano is going to join us around 10. And, you know, given that we're going to be on Thanksgiving break next Wednesday and Thursday at least, and maybe Friday, don't know yet. A lot of times I'm ready by Friday morning to get, you know, to get rolling. And it's a good weekend. I mean, the Thanksgiving holiday weekend and this period is there's a lot of good racing. I mean, if you're nobody can complain. Honestly, nobody should be complaining about the field size and the quality of spots. I mean, if you, you know, if you're looking for good opportunities, they're out there. And in fact, the weekend cards, the Saturday cards, got drawn yesterday. Del Mar and Aqueduct, etc. Churchill already had drawn, and I was trying to make some determination about today's Thoroughgraph visit. Jeff Franklin, actually, you know that Jeff is dealing with you know, kind of a health situation. So he had some follow-up this week to what he was dealing with. And so he won't be on today. So probably won't hear from Jeff for 2 weeks. But I've got a couple of races to look at. The Hill Prince Saturday at Aqueduct, and at Churchill, the Chalukee. Love Chalukee. Good cards. Good cards everywhere. Del Mar, too. Del Mar kind of holding back. You know, they got some calibrate action, and kind of holding back for the Hollywood Turf Festival. But anyway, Gary Palmisano, top of hour two, will address this Churchill turf situation. They're not happy, and in concert with the jocks, they're not happy with the way the turf course is playing, and apparently, you know, horses getting over it. It's being described as loose, and this has really been a problematic topic, obviously. So Gary will address that. I reached out to him, you know, days ago in advance of tomorrow's opening at Fairgrounds, and Super, as we mentioned with Neil Pessin, terrific start to the meet. It looks like three stakes, and you know, one thing I always say about Fairgrounds, I didn't slip it in yesterday. There's no racetrack in the country. I mean, every track has races, memorial races. No track has a greater sense of duty to the horsemen and the community and everything associated with their own, you know, with their own history as a racetrack than Fairgrounds. And that's quite evident, you know, right away tomorrow. And in fact, you know, both of the cards already that have been drawn. So you've got, you go with three, I think, right? Yeah. The Doris Hebert and the John Valine Memorial, as well as the Donovan Ferguson, all tomorrow. Nice card to get the season going. So we'll talk with Gary about that, and actually we'll look ahead because Turfway, when it comes to the Turfway season, I guess we'll have a window, but we'll let Gary also tip the hand a little bit about Turfway. There's something I want to reach out to Walker Hancock. There's that program that they're going to be doing with Claiborne at Turfway. I'm sure we'll touch on as well. So Gary Palmisano Jr. We'll get to Tony Black, Joe Clancy today, and Sean. I was trying to get both Clancys to get, you know, kind of a Thanksgiving message from them, and you know, this audience, of course, very excited about the Clancy Christmas tree. so we know that Joe's going to join us. Not sure about Sean. Dave Hill, of course, later. And NFL week, what, 11? Yeah, week 11. And finally, one of the most anticipated visits of the year, one of everybody's favorite segments, celebrity chef Neil Kleinberg. We're probably going to have two chef visits before Thanksgiving because I'm not going to miss a chance to have Frank Bryson on. But Neil, Clinton Street Baking Company, been doing this, my God, 8, 9, 10 years. Neil's going to join us. We'll see if there's any new trends, anything that you need to be out in front of a week from today. Thanksgiving, our favorite. So, Neil Kleinberg later. Matt Hegarty, Chris Block, Gary Palmisano Jr., Tony Black, Joe Clancy, Dave Hill, Neil Kleinberg, and I wanted to get Seth back in. We'll see if we can't find Seth before the holiday. Sean Clancy is Clancy. Nobody brings out. I'm very proud. I'll say this to Joe. I'm very proud of the fact that I'm able to to play straight man to Sean Clancy, right? Clancy is never funnier than when I give him those volleyball setups. That's Let's get Hegarty in here, and then we'll start. We'll also look at some racing. We're running today, by the way. We're in the sixth at Aqueduct. Now, I toyed with going down, but it a little too much going on. So we'll watch along with everybody else. But you know, the turf season, you know, kind of got kind of went a little sideways for us. But obviously, they're dealing with the same thing in Louisville. And, you know, only a handful of turf races left in New York through Sunday. I'm anxious to hear from Hegarty. I also reached out to Paul Matisse. Paul, I think, was the first person to, that was while he was watching the action yesterday. I think he was the first person to, you know, kind of send up a flare that the pool, you know, that there was a pool anomaly is anomaly a good word? We'll see if Matt Hegarty agrees. I just called yesterday's toad action an anomaly, but seems like it was more than that. Matt Hegarty, good morning. Appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Good morning, Steve. I'm sorry I wasn't listening to the prior speaker, so I don't know what the segue involves, but I'll be happy to talk about what I do know. So,
well, there really wasn't. I just, you know, I opened the show talking about it and saying that you were going to come on. I also mentioned that I reached out to Curtis Linnell, and TRPB has got kind of a, I'm sure they're investigating, but they're it's not their bailiwick, essentially. Linnell saying that the jurisdictions and the racetracks themselves, the associations that were affected, would be the ones to look to comment. Why don't you tell everybody what you encountered and the nuts and bolts of what happened yesterday?
Yeah, so obviously this spread like wildfire through the racing community, because the size of the wagers, which were bet into super exotic pools, or at least the ones that really set off the alarms, were bet into super exotic pools at harness tracks and at Finger Lakes, in addition to Churchill Downs at some point in the afternoon. The totals were so stratospheric that no one who knows anything about parimutuel wagering wouldn't be shocked by what was going on. They did instantly set off red flags at Curtis's unit at the TRPB, and you did have one track, Churchill Downs, which had $750,000 go into its super high five pool, actually hold the payoffs. So these were going to be noticed, right? Which is where it gets confusing. If you were going to try to pull off a betting coup, it helps not to be conspicuous. It's kind of confusing as to what the grand strategy, if there was one, behind these bets. Now, according to several officials, the bets that went into the Superfecta and Super High Five were bet using all in the Superfecta, and then one more all in the Super High Five. And they weren't a bet at a small denomination. They were at large denominations multiple times. So you're guaranteed to generate a bunch of winning bets. The only problem is you were driving down the price of the payoff by betting at these huge combinations. And these are in pools in which you can sometimes take down the entire pool at the minimum denomination. If you looked at the second Finger Lakes one, it was one or three positions in the super were horses that were long shots. You could have taken that entire pool with the 10-cent bet. So everyone is kind of scratching their heads. There could be some nuanced strategy I don't know about where this would lead to either either a positive return in some sort of bizarre way. But what we saw yesterday was that they instantly generated attention, and the betting strategy that was used would not be a betting strategy of someone who had a good knowledge of how parimutuel markets work. So this is odd. It's very strange.
If it was one venue and one race and one big, large denomination, which we have seen in the past, it could feel like then it's an anomaly and a miscue, from a, maybe a batch better. But the fact that this was happening in a variety of pools and in two different, sports, in harness and in thoroughbred. I mean, that part of it makes it interesting. And obviously the first, early assumptions were and have been that this is, computer batch betting, CAW, gone wild.
No, that is not what happened. The interesting thing about this is that, those CRW programs are just sitting there waiting, right? They're waiting for a betting opportunity to show up. I do have the exact ticket detail from one of the races, and it looks like the CRWs got triggered when the bets went in, because now there's all this liquidity in the pool, and they're saying, okay, the computers themselves, they're not saying it, but the algorithms say work off, get triggered once a pool reaches a certain size, and then they devise a betting strategy based on the win odds or the will pays in say the exact pools to come up with a bet. It looks like the CRWs were triggered in those pools. So while the person did bet an extraordinary amount, person or persons, an extraordinary amount in each of these pools, it also triggered other people and CRWs to start looking at them and putting their own bets in. Now, those people would have gotten screwed because the person had bet so much that, you looked at that one superfecta payout, it was $22 on a 10-cent wager, right?
Right.
So right now it's a confusing situation. What we do know does not point to any sophisticated attempt to wager off this. I think it's important to look at the FanDuel statement that cited both a technical glitch and potential fraud. It is possible that someone was able to manipulate an account balance. If that account balance, suddenly went from 1,000 to, three more decimal places to 1,000,000. Perhaps your strategy was to churn a bunch of money, but it was still going to be noticed. And how did you think you were going to be able to withdraw it? And if you were able to manipulate an account balance, why wouldn't you just try to withdraw it without betting huge amounts of money into the pool, right? None of this makes any sense.
No. What happens from here? How do these, how are these being tracked? And obviously you got Kentucky involved, you've got Pennsylvania involved, New York, New York, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky would be the three jurisdictions, right?
Right. Yeah. So at this point, the accounts were shut off. They were shut off mid-afternoon. We know for sure that the accounts were, the account was active for at least, right, a half an hour, probably more. And so they know who the person is, right? You have to provide detailed personal information to bet through any account wagering operation. And so PVG FanDuel will be doing its own auditing and investigation. But because these did happen, licensed horse races, the racing commissions will also be involved. I don't think there are many racing commissions in which this is their expertise. They will certainly have plenty of data to look at. And you absolutely know that TVG FanDuel is interested in finding out what happened. Even if the bets were based on a fake balance, right? Some of them got paid off, but it would have kind of gotten paid off in fake money. It's kind of like, you know, investing in cryptocurrency. You know, you've got a bunch of fake money and then you just sold a bunch of fake money, right? So it is, it's, like I said, it's only been, what, you know, 17 hours or something since it started happening. And the, what did happen, leads to so many more questions, because it just does not seem like anything you could get away with. And the strategy employed, as I said, looks on the face of it to be ignorant of parimutuel, how parimutuel markets work.
Well, it'll be this will be interesting. The obviously the interest, you know, from the horse playing community, you know, the triggers certain concerns, Matt, about pool integrity and you know, especially in light of data breaches. And you know, we had that conversation, actually had an interesting conversation with Ed Martin, you know, in light of what went on in Vegas last month or 6 weeks ago now. And, you know, so people get, you know, people get instantly uneasy. But this sounds like that potential doesn't seem likely.
Yeah, maybe rephrase it. I'm not sure what you're saying.
About data breach or you know, hacking elements. I mean, you did include that, I guess, as part of the, you know, potential outcomes or you know, sources of what went on when you mentioned you know, somebody reaching and finding a, you know, an account. But it's
yeah, and even if you did this, say a smart way, let's say if there's a way to do it smartly, right? Then you were doing it at small denominations, and you were still using the all, right? At some point, you know, W-2Gs are going to be triggered depending on the investment.
Right.
You would think one would hit, you know. At this, you know, I've tried it from this angle too, where it's like, well, what about, you know, evading taxes or money laundering? Yeah, the investment is so huge that, yeah, you're not going to trigger the W-2G except in a really weird circumstance, because the payoffs are so small and you bet so much money. But let's just say you were doing it at small denominations, but you were still using the same structure of the bet, the all, and all, right? And it looks like some trifecta and exacta pools, I need to say that, were targeted as well. So we don't know much about those yet. Even if you were doing that, at some point, the internal systems are going to say, hey, we have a better here that it's just cash, like superfecta after superfecta. Let's look at the ticket data and find out somebody's betting all. And that is not a good long-term betting strategy. If it was, then all of us would be doing it. You know, they're going to get caught at some point. Or someone is going to be looking at it very, you know, very closely. So it boggles the mind right now. And I have been thinking about this, you know, since it started, and I can't come up with a strategy. And I've talked to people and they can't come up with a strategy here that works in the long term.
I see, you know, I see different theories and ideas floated. Basically it's a curiosity until we get a wider explanation.
Right. Yeah, but we do know, you know, as far as I have been told, we do know this was not a CRW that went haywire. We do know that. Yeah.
There you go. Well, I appreciate
it. It would be
that.
Kind of a cool narrative, though, right? That if an AI just, you know, went insane.
Yes.
And this is what
exactly, right?
Yeah,
that would be...
like it's the first CRW to actually get a gambling addiction, right?
AI is all excited.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what support group you have to go to if you're an AI with a gambling addiction. So
it's going to be a kind of across a few different lines. And while I've got you, Matt, too, I expect we'll see you at Symposium.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right. And maybe, given that it's 2.5 weeks away, we'll know more.
You would hope that this is pretty easy to unwind, right? You have the culprit. You know who did it. You have all of the pool and individual ticket data. You would hope that FanDuel, is going to be, invested in transparency on this one to tell everyone what happened, because trust in the parimutuel markets is, if not the top priority for the racing industry, it should be, right? No one's going to bet into markets that are showing this much unexplainable volatility. So we just have to hope that FanDuel is committed to a transparent treatment of this. I know that's an overused word, and I'm not particularly fond of it, transparency. But in this case, they definitely should let everyone know exactly what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And I haven't really discussed the pool integrity conversation since the white paper that Pat Cummings offered up a couple of years ago. He did a series about pool integrity, but this obviously, this is a tangent from that conversation. So it'll be very interesting to see the outcome. Matt, additionally, while I've got you, because I didn't get a chance to talk to you last week, I had Frank Angst, and we referenced your Breeders' Cup handle piece as part of the conversation about the one that he offered up, which was kind of a little opinion missive. You dove into the dollars a little bit more in detail, and I am curious to have you flesh a little bit more of that out. 'Cause one thing that didn't seem to be discussed as part of the suggestions about the BC handle was the field size and the problems that might be associated with horses basically X'd out by the veterinarians. Give everybody your conclusions.
Yeah, in total, right? In total, the field sizes were not impacted to a large degree. I understand that the scratches made it look like that, right? But you had 99 in the 9 Breeders' Cup races on Saturday, if I'm remembering right. You had 93 this year. So that is, getting close to about, 0.75 of a horse per Breeders' Cup race. But and you're definitely going to see some fall off, right? But for the most part, you did have full enough fields, right? The handle goes down at a much higher rate when you're cutting from 7 to 6 to 6 to 5 than it does, say, from 11 to 10, right? This was a head scratcher for me as well. Worst case scenario, the Churchill fatalities, is the worst case scenario for the racing industry, or just eroding public interest or trust is the worst case scenario. But I think there were a couple things that you don't normally think of that would be affecting this. One was weather, right? I do spreadsheets for all the Triple Crown races plus all the Breeders' Cup races every year, pool by pool. And if there's one odd one that you always have to think about, and this especially affects, say, the Derby, Preakness, Belmont, where you're looking at one race. But I do the full cards on those as well. If it is gorgeous weather on the eastern seaboard you know, or east of the Mississippi, handle numbers generally go down. People in the afternoon that might be sitting at home on a rainy day that do like racing, their soccer tournaments are not getting canceled, their kids' soccer tournaments, there's a bunch of stuff that you can do outside. So that, I think, is a factor. But you're still also looking at the fact that when the races are held on the West Coast, you do normally get a big bump from that because the races are held later in the day for those East Coast people. We didn't see that. In fact, we saw a big contraction. Last year's Breeders' Cup handle set a record. It was strong across the board, just about everywhere. So if you compare it to the, was it Del Mar 2 years ago, I believe it was, they were kind of comparable, but they were still down from that. You have an inflationary economy. You do have at least the middle classes having their budgets strained quite a bit over the last couple of years. So could there be an overall effect of the weakness in discretionary income from the middle class right now? That could surely be a factor as well. Breeders' Cup has said we're taking a look at it. They would not answer my specific questions after the Breeders' Cup, speaking of transparency. And so we'll see what happens. The obvious big one, big question I had, what are you going to do with the Classic next year, right?
Yeah.
Is it a good idea to hold two Breeders' Cup races with very limited media coverage after the Classic? I did read Frank's piece, who said that, you know, those two races were actually up a small bit when you compared them to handle two races before. But, Frank is great. Frank knows what he's doing. My opinion is the proper way. That's not a proper comparison because of the race order, that you would have to kind of look at the last two race handles of all previous years to see how much they're above preceding race handles. It's a complicated analysis, but you saw massive, obviously, drop-offs just on a race-to-race basis based on their position in the card. So I think there's a lot of moving parts to the analysis of that, and race order is one of the big ones. NBC is locked into that Big Ten contract on Saturday night, so we are going to see the Classic go off at early evening for the next 3 years, 2 years, sorry, at least. So we'll see how they address that.
I'll only suggest that part of the handle issue, and particularly for Saturday, the dirt fields, Matt. When you look at that sprint, you look at the dirt mile. It sure feels like consolidation would benefit. It would, you know, as opposed to, you know, the way this icing is being spread on a sheet cake. I'd rather have, you know, a 14 horse sprint, you know, than a 9 and an 8 of those two races. I mean, I think they're hurting the multi race wagers, the doubles, the pick threes, the pick fours, the pick five. You know, the distaff didn't have a full field. I mean, the turf races, they're drawing. They're full. It's the dirt races that are suffering, and I think impacting these numbers.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the 40-some Europeans that came over this year. I wasn't prepared for this conversation, so
that's all right.
Please, I apologize if my numbers are wrong. Obviously, those are targeting the turf races, right?
Yep.
With the dirt races, you're basically using the American population plus the Japanese population, what the Japanese send over. But totally my opinion. Yeah, I agree with you. I liked it better when the first Breeders' Cup I went to, I wasn't in, you know, I didn't have a job, was the San Anita one at 93. And I can remember every race, and that's because there were seven of them. And, you know, having the one day event, you know, what is the proper size of the Breeders' Cup now? Seven is probably too few, considering the different divisions we have. But 14 seems to be spreading it a little thin.
Yeah, agreed. And I don't know how they put the genie back in the bottle, to be honest. Yeah, because even a race like the Fillion Mare Sprint, which is I think if we go back to the Monmouth, it was the Monmouth Breeders' Cup that had the first expansion, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was first 2 days, sure.
And when they started adding the races, but
it was 11 back then, wasn't it?
I think that's right. That sounds right. Because we had
7 and 4, right? I think it was 7 and 4 with that first two year.
Well, because you had the Fillion Mare Sprint and the Fillion Mare Turf were the first two, Saturday races. And actually, the Dirt Mile must have been added then too, because there was the rather humorous mile and 40 yards, as the distance, yeah. Or mile and 70,
right.
Which I remember caused some snickering. I don't know. I just to me, paring back and filling out the fields and making them as big as possible, it would benefit. And if we had less races to bet, we would bet them, more heavily. So that's my
view. Yeah, I personally don't bet two-year-old races very much over the last, going back 10 years, I've been increasingly reserving my bankroll for Saturday. This is a day just like the Triple Crown races where, if you don't hit a race, you are stretching your bankroll if you're a cautious player and have limits on what you can do. When you see, as we did on Friday, where you had just so many long shots, there wasn't any churn. That was my big theory on Friday, right?
Interesting.
Is that nobody was cashing any tickets. No wonder you're seeing handle eroding. But then Saturday's results made me think about it again, because then all you had were favorites.
That's right.
You saw handle a road in places you shouldn't, in the multi race, especially bets. It was an odd handle result on a lot of different fronts. And so we'll just see how Breeders' Cup reacts to it.
Matt, another topic you wrote frequently over the last week and a half, the Arizona situation, and this continues to evolve, and it seems like slow, steady progress is being made on this revitalized turf paradise plan. Bring everybody up to speed on that, because I haven't addressed it.
Yeah, I would say if you're a journalist or a long suffering horse racing fan in Arizona, cards on the table, I am from Phoenix. Turf Paradise was my home track. Then you would have to have doubts about an announcement of a new group coming in to run racing there and be committed to racing. But then I was on the Racing Commission meeting last week, and their chief state steward said, "Oh, I've been by there, and there's these repairs going on." You wouldn't be repairing something that you want to tear down, obviously. So even in the short term, maybe there is some hope for Turf Paradise running, but you just have to remain skeptical until they have horsemen on the grounds and a condition book out, right? We'll have to see. But this group does say that they're coming in to race. The situation there is one in which if you do race, no one else is racing there with the exception of Rieto, then you do control the simulcasts through the off-track betting network year-round. It's actually not a bad market for full-card simulcasting. You can generate, you know, quite a bit of money there. Can it work at the price we think Turf Paradise is being bought for? A lot of people I talk to say that if the number is around that 100, 120 number, it's very hard to break even with the full card simulcasts. So long-term future, you still have your doubts. But short-term is certainly looking better than it did, say, whatever it was, late September, when right. A buyer just came out of the blue, right? Like, literally out of the blue.
Very much. But the fact that HPPA went ahead and to pull from Congress, we had a continuing resolution, right?
continuing. Exactly. Yeah. So that's so now the simulcasts are still available through the end of the year. The buyers say that, hey, we should be able to get this thing done by middle of December. The only problem is the licensing process, how long that takes, and then also certification or accreditation from HISA. So we'll see what happens there. It's by no means a settled matter, and we'll just have to keep watching.
Let me also, you mentioned HISA, and you had both sides or both pieces that are corollaries when it comes to the Regimate situation and Tally Lynch with the two-year suspensions. And then simultaneously, HISA reclassifying the products like Mary Mare and Regimate. What did you make of those two parallel track stories, and what do you expect to happen as Lynch and her attorney appeal the arbitrator decision?
Yeah, well, you know, when she's appealing that decision, that just because they're planning to reclassify it, if the rule change does get approved by the FTC, doesn't mean that the new reclassification applies. So that is going to be a high hurdle. If you read the arbitrator's report, it seems that Lynch was not entirely truthful when she was speaking to either investigators or the arbitration panel. I think that hurt her case quite a bit. So she's going to face a high hurdle going to the FTC. Now, maybe they can say, well, at the time that this case was being adjudicated, right, we know that HISA was having discussions with its Horsemen's Advisory Group, who have veterinarians who say that the extra label use of this in geldings and intact males does have a benefit during layup, right? The line from HISA is that if you have a horse that that came out of surgery or something like that, or is otherwise on the farm, that it's okay to use this in this controlled environment, right? So, you know, would Natalia's horse testing positive after a race at a concentration that does appear as if it was administered within 24 hours of the race, would she be eligible for exacerbating circumstances here under the controlled medication? I don't know.
Right.
Their reclassification, at least the wording they were using, made it sound like they were going to apply it to a prescription use for a horse, colt or intact male, after or during a layup period, right? I don't know how they're going to enforce that. That's where it's really nuanced, right, in Natalia's case. I don't. Like I said, I think it's a high hurdle for her to escape some sort of meaningful punishment for the two violations.
Matt Hegarty, everybody, the Daily Racing Form, of course, the hard news correspondent that is as busy as Dave Grenning and Steve Anderson combined.
No, that is not true.
Well, you know, I'm curious. I'm curious. Is there going to be coverage of the coronation of the owner that named himself commissioner of the industry?
I'm assuming you're speaking about people, right? So I know as much as I avoid Twitter as much as possible, I have seen, just because I've had to check some stuff related to the bets, that he seems to be holding a lot of polls out there, asking people, you know, various questions about certain things. So at least we'll get a better understanding of what the Twitter public thinks, which is probably not worth much. So.
There was actually a very funny rejoinder of a poll. Chris Larmy, he managed to distill Rapoli's concerns to being the purse for the Derby, the field size of the Derby, and the vet policies of the Derby. Those seem to be the three priorities that Mike has cultivated.
Yeah, well, you know, Mike has brought a very smart, very tenacious guy on board with Pat Cummings. I know. And Pat, I'm friendly with Pat, but even when Craig actually started, you know, the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation,
right.
I did not have a whole lot of, you know, high hopes for, right. for them getting stuff done. But you really have to say that does the breakage bill get passed without Pat doing all the research and lobbying on
no.
it here in Kentucky?
No.
He brought attention to some issues that resulted in meaningful discussion, backed up by good data. So you do have to say that if Repol is serious about this, at least he has a good guy at the top of his I can't find a word I don't want to put scare quotes around organization, let's say
the flow chart.
Yeah,
on the flow chart, there we go. No, it's well intentioned, and Pat, it's obvious that this is going to be kind of a parallel track. You know, Pat will take it, will be very serious, and Mike Rapoli will be a little bit more, you know, fun and flippant about this.
Right. So, right. Yeah.
Matt, I look forward to seeing you in Arizona, and waiting for you. We'll watch your bylines and your reporting on this tote frenzy, as I called it, and happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you. Thanks for having me on.
Always great. Matt Hegarty, everybody, who is just so good. Chris Block is going to join us here before we talk to Gary Pomisano, G-Pal, the prince. By the way, speaking of princes, I did notice this morning that Darren Rogers sending out birthday wishes. Davis Rogers, who, those of you listening on the show over the years, you know that Davis basically grew up on the show with his annual Derby pick, I saw this morning that Davis is turning 18 today, which is like insane. It's crazy to think that he's 18. So happy birthday, Davis. You can't call him Little D anymore if he's 18 years old. Going to go to Louisville a few times, as mentioned, because Gary Pomisano will join us next. But Chris Block is visiting first, and Yesterday, Chris, the very sad news, and the more we think about it, the potentially devastating news of Bob Lothenbach's passing at the age of 64. And Sid Fernando paid tribute yesterday. Sid worked for him on the matings. Then Neil Pessin joined us, and I thought of you and Ian and Wilkes and Carl Navsker and Joel Berndt, and then everybody on breeding, on the breeding community side in Minnesota. I mean, this is just so sad.
Yeah, it is. Hi, Steve, and it's a major blow to all of us that were close to Bob. He was a very, very, very loyal client of mine. I think it's been 20 to 25 years I've trained for him.
Wow.
The special connection I had with Bob was that most of my success with Bob was with the homebreds, not the ones he bought at the sale. And he knows how close my family is to the breeding part of it as well. And so we held a connection there as far as you know, very proud of the horses that he was able to breed that went on to be successful, whether they were just the good old hard working horses on a monthly basis or the graded stakes winners. But the thing that I know and remember the best of Bob is that he just let us do our job, and he never ever entered in with a question on anything where he would say, "What are you guys doing? And doesn't make sense, or let me add my 2 cents to this." He left us alone, let us do our job. He, after a race, win, lose, or draw, it was the same Bob Lothenbach. Win, lose, or draw, he was happy to win, and he was not sad to lose, because he'd just say, "Let's buckle up and try to do better next time." So not only for all of us that were worked for him and were his friend, for the industry as well, this is going to be a huge loss.
You mentioned the quarter century association with him, and yesterday with Neil, Neil cited you and credited you with basically getting overflow horses, having the opportunity to train for Bob Lothenbach, and then ultimately end up with his first Grade One horse. And I mean, Neil was anguished, obviously, as well. But you helped spread the wealth, essentially.
Yes. Well, I'm thankful for Neil for saying that, because Neil and I are very good friends, and that's exactly how it came about. It actually kind of started with Vicar. I brought Vicar down from Hawthorne to run at Keeneland and in the Queen Elizabeth, went in the Neal's barn. And I think it just kind of took off from there, where Bob got to know Neil, and next you know, Neil had some horses for Bob, and then it built up to something that kind of on a small scale, but then it got to be very bigger toward the last few years here. Neil's had a lot of horses for Bob, and I know they've enjoyed a great friendship as well. So it's pretty darn tough on all of us. And as Joel Berndt, I talked to Joel yesterday. He was very emotional when I talked to him yesterday. I've never heard Joel like that. And his connection in Minnesota, I mean, Bob, Minnesota racing and breeding is going to have a huge hole in it. Bob was so dedicated to that program up there and to Canterbury Park. And Joel had really he really entrusted Joel with many, many horses to race as much as possible, because the meet isn't very long there, and try to win as much as possible. And they were very successful. And, Joel told me last night, he said, Chris, Bob would come to the track and we'd have talk business for 10 minutes. And the rest of the time was running horses and just having a good time. And that's what Bob loved. When he was at the track, he just wanted to come there, enjoy watching his horse run, but also he'd bet every other race on the card and just enjoy the day.
One other thing that Neil said, post-race conversations, win or lose, 30 seconds.
Yeah, that Neil's 100% right. They were not very long. Yeah, I mean, it was You know, he had so much going on in his life, so much in the business world, that he'd take the time to jump away from what he was doing to take my call and hear what happened. And then he'd say, Chris, I got to get back at it. So Neil's right. It wasn't very long. That's correct.
And you know, just the fact that you put it in that, you know, that he had to get back, in other words, back to work. And, you know, yesterday you know, my first reaction, very similar to the one we had when Paul Pompa, and I was close to Paul Pompa, when, you know, Paul sells his business, you know, the guy that worked 18 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week for 35, 40 years, sells the business and dies 6 months later. And this has that same, has a kind of a similar feel, right? I mean, I mean, this is a guy that should have had, you know, 25 more years of you know, not just involvement in the game, but, you know, with family and so forth. I mean, Neil talked about how the, you know, a lot of the horses would be named after the kids and you know, the family members. And I just, you know, we can't afford, the industry can't afford to lose people like this.
Yeah, and it's you're correct, Stephen. I told this to Neil, and I also had the discussion with Chad Stewart. And Chad.
Oh runs, yeah,
in Ocala. And he has all the yearlings and high-ups. And I mean, at any given time, you know, Chad would have anywhere between 40 and 50 head of horses for Bob, and at his facility there. And we always said that. You know, I believe, and when Drew Nardiello worked for Bob as well,
sure.
Drew and I would talk about, you know, boy, I hope we never lose Bob, right? Because you're not going to be able to replace this man on all levels of not only the industry and the business of horse racing and breeding, but as a friend as well, because he truly was a good friend.
What horses come to mind? I mean, early successes and as things evolved, you know, with you and Lothenbach.
Well, of course, Vicar probably is one of the ones at the top.
Oh yeah,
she vaulted right to the top and was a homebred and got my first Grade One win. And Bob and his family were there for that. So that's a memory I'll never forget. And then the old blue collar horse, Mr. Mardi Gras, was one that really, that really stuck out because, he was a millionaire and won on, at numerous tracks and different distances and another homebred. So, you know, those two, and then, probably Captivating Moon, even though he didn't win much, he was always a major conversation between Bob and I on how we could get him to win, and what races made the most sense. I'll never forget when I had, had Captivating Moon as a 3-year-old, I had a race picked out for him at Arlington. Bob never asked for anything. He never asked for anything. But the one thing he did ask, he said, Chris, can you please bring him to Canterbury and run him in the Mystic Lake Derby? It's in my backyard. Aww. I said, you don't have to ask twice. He'll be there. And we were third in that, but a strong closing third. But it's the only thing you ever asked for. And you know, Steve, the one other thing I want to add also is he was very, very giving when it came to the sales. He let us pick them out.
Right.
And he let us set the value. He was a little involved in the breeding part of it, which I thought was great. But you set the value and you went into the ring and, you know, sometimes he'd say, you know, if you want him so bad, let's go a little further and get him. That's something I'll never forget too, because, I don't go to the sales much, for other clients, but for that experience, it made it very comfortable to go down there to Keeneland or wherever we went to look, because you knew he was going to have your back and was going to be, trusting you to pick out what you think would help further his racing stable.
You know, and you mentioned Vicar, because I remember her with Chris Clement, right? In the second half, was that a second half of her career? Did she go?
Yes.
Was she acquired?
Yes. Yes. John and Sarah Kelly. We sold her at the Night of the Stars as a after she won the Queen Elizabeth.
I really don't think
to this day that Bob was real happy about selling her. Her value was, I believe she brought 2.8. And I do remember that evening, and Drew Nardiello and his staff had consigned her. And, Bob, he called me, probably about 30 minutes before she was going to the ring. And he said, "Hey, Chris, you need to go over and tell Drew, let's just set the reserve at, I think he said 2. And I was like, "Oh, I'm in the middle of this." So I walked briskly over to the barn, and Drew came out and met me out in the middle, there before I ever got to the barn, and said, "I've already talked to him. We're not changing the reserve." And she exceeded the reserve. I think the reserve was 2.5. But yeah, John and Sarah Kelly bought her and went on and did quite well with her, actually, with Christopher Clement. But Bob, I don't think ever sold another race mare. I mean, like Bell's the One went through the ring and he bought her back. He if there was one thing that I think Bob probably was a little over the top with, was he just didn't want to give anything up. And he said, and that's not a fault by any means. He just built up so many horses that he wanted to build an empire of not only breeding stock, but racing stock as well. So not many of them went to the sale ring.
Well, as we talked yesterday with Neil, we kind of got around to some of the horses, and I'm going to talk about the Chalukie later, and She Can't Sing jumped off the page.
Yes, well, I should have mentioned her as well. I mean, She Can't Sing, this is be her last race, and she's going to become a broodmare. She's had not the best of year this year. I opted to bring her back for one more go of another season, and it's nothing physically with her. It just hasn't been the right races, and she's probably regressed a little on the grass. But she has an affinity for Churchill. She won this race last year, albeit it was a little softer spot than it is this year. But she's doing really, really well. I'm anxious to give her one more chance to see what she can do. And she likes the mile out of the chute there at Churchill. So she's been a special one for us. Well, yet again, another homebred. I haven't had a lot of success with the horses I've bought for Bob, but I've had a lot of success with the homebred. So I'm real proud to go into the paddock to saddle her on Saturday evening and give her one more chance to hopefully go out with something positive as she heads off to another career.
Well, that would be ideal. And of course, the ones that Neil is saddling this weekend as well at Churchill, and then on to Fairgrounds and the winter. Obviously, it's gonna take some doing to figure out how, as far flung an operation as Lothenbach Racing, how they're going to proceed. So,
yes,
it would certainly be, if this is her last race on top of everything else, she has made 38 starts coming into Saturday, the 6-year-old Bernardini mare, and she's made $875,000. So on top of everything else, if she wins, she'll be a millionaire.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be special?
All right. Yeah. I think there's enough. I think there's enough juju involved in this now to put her over the top. I hope, Chris. I appreciate it, and I know how difficult it's going to be for everybody. You mentioned Joel Burnt, and you folded in Chad Stewart, and the more I think about it, I haven't reached out to Ian yet and to Carl. There's a lot of tentacles that are involved here, not to mention all the charities that he gave so generously to. So, as always, somebody of this racing attracts quality individuals like Bob Lothenbach, and we hate losing them.
There's no doubt about it, and that you're right, Steve. There's a lot of tentacles to Bob Lothenbach, and a lot that people don't realize, but. The industry lost a phenomenal horseman, breeder, owner, And all of us lost a dear friend as well. And I appreciate you taking the time to pay tribute to him.
No, it's that's an imperative. Chris, happy Thanksgiving to you and the family. Typically, I bring up Illinois and stuff, but we'll save that for a victory recap conversation. All right.
That sounds great. Thanks, Steve. Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
I appreciate it. Chris Block, everybody, and the Block family, of course, as big as Lothenbach has been to Minnesota, the Blocks, you know, a major building block of Illinois racing. Let's stay in Louisville, and I want to get to, before the break, Gary Pomisano Jr., G-Pal, is going to join us. Big couple of weeks coming up here as we get the opening tomorrow of Fairgrounds, and of course Gary's got two hometowns. He's got the Ville and he's got NOLA, so he's fortunate in that regard. But he can speak lovingly about the action on Gentilly that kicks off tomorrow, and then 10 days later they're going to get going for the winter season at Turfway. And, of course, Turfway has been kept open and used as a training facility that has been feeding into Ellis and Churchill and Keeneland and Kentucky Downs. And now they'll get their season rolling. Gary, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm good. Starting to look at Thanksgiving. Everybody knows that I'm a bit of a Thanksgiving freak. It's one of our favorite things. Certainly this season also plays heavily down in New Orleans. Everybody's getting ready to, a couple more weeks of racing at Churchill, and then everybody will either stay home and turn their attention to Turfway, or they'll maybe head, like Neil Pessin was with us yesterday, paying tribute to Bob Lothenbach. Chris Block was just on. They'll start to head down to New Orleans. We'll talk about that in a minute. But let's first address and get your update on the turf situation that is now, essentially scuttled racing the last few days at the Downs.
Yeah, no. I think there's been a couple of media reports talking a little bit about it. Basically, it feels loose underneath the riders. The horses aren't quite grabbing it. They're kind of, like I said, the riders just feel like it's just loose is the word they keep using. And we're just not ready or not thinking that it's where we want it to be right now. And it's not where it needs to be to sustain 2 and 3 turf races a day. So we're sort of just scaling back and, taking it day by day and picking our spots of when to try to use it. Obviously disappointing. It was a huge, investment on our part to try to have a state of the art horse that, would meet the demands of increased racing. And, we're going to continue to evaluate it. We've got a number of experts and consultants and everyone on the ground here sort of trying to look at it. But yeah, I think we're not satisfied with the current condition. And again, riders just feel like it's a little loose underneath them. And we're going to take it day by day and see if we can offer some racing over the next couple 2 weeks and do the best we can over the winter to evaluate it and have it ready for spring.
And I imagine, especially with the 2-year-olds, how much stake action remains on the calendar? Did we lose Gary? No, I think, that's a drop. That's a call drop. Let's get him back. Let me see here. I'll go to, there we go. Gary, got you back? No, not at all.
Got the Mrs. Revere and the Commonwealth there next week, which are two important grass stakes on the calendar for the fall meet. So, those are obviously of importance to try to get out there. So yeah, I think it's a day by day decision, and we're gonna do obviously what's open dialogue with our riders and make sure we're being overly cautious.
I mean, was this basically generated by the jocks?
I think just conversations between the jocks and management. I mean, just again, it just not meeting our satisfaction.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on it. In the meantime, let's turn our attention down to New Orleans. And one thing that does, when it comes to grass, look terrific is the turf course at Fairgrounds. And after the salination issue from last year, they spent, I guess, the whole summer, you know, once the Jazz and Heritage Festival broke down, everything was basically focused on getting that turf course ready for tomorrow. And it looks beautiful from every indication and report that we're getting.
Yeah, no, you know, we had the hiccup last year. To your point, as soon as the season was over this year, we brought some folks in down there to make sure we crossed every T and dotted every I, and that course was restored back to the condition that we know it can be and it should be. And I think, to your point, by all accounts, we're ready to rock and roll tomorrow.
I've got the card in front of me, and I mentioned, and I say this all the time, there's no racetrack that pays tribute to participants and community like Fairgrounds does, and that includes a race for your late father as well. Talk about the program and the season and the anticipation as we kick it off tomorrow at Fairgrounds.
Yeah, I'm personally extremely excited about the winter meet. We've got some fresh faces on the trainer side coming down. Obviously, it's been documented that Larry Rivelli will have a big presence. A number of new folks from Kentucky, Whit Beckman, Carlo Vacareza showing up down there, Armando Hernandez, who's an Illinois mainstay. And, you know, our trainer colony was always, you know, cream of the crop with Brad and Steve and, you know, Mike Maker and Joe Sharp. I mean, it's a who's who of horsemen down there. We rebuilt two barns, which allowed us to have 80 or so new stalls to be able to bring in some fresh faces and, you know, really kind of just rejuvenate the trainer colony a little bit down there and eager to see how all that shakes out. We've got a strong riding colony coming back, a number of new riders showing up. And yeah, I think there's just a renewed enthusiasm for the race meet there, and it's going to be extremely exciting to kick off tomorrow. And obviously, the highlight of the season down there is the 3-year-old season. You know, again, produced a Kentucky Oaks winner, pretty mischievous. I think might have hit all three Oaks preps down there. Two Phils was second in the Derby. He came out of the Risen Star. Disarm was fourth in the Derby. He came out of Louisiana Derby. Angel of Empire was third in the Kentucky Derby. He came out of the New Orleans Road. So over the last couple of years, I'm pretty proudly probably boasting that the road to Kentucky is in both the boys and the girls divisions have been pretty prominently through New Orleans, which is exciting. And then the new addition to the meet down there this year is the Claiming Crown on December 2nd, which will be an exciting day of racing, and we're thrilled to have that day back.
Very much. And I, you know, we should also include, you know, the Louisiana bred program, especially, you know, these next couple of weeks. You look at a card like tomorrow's and you see the stakes. You know, you got the 2-year-old Louisiana bred maiden race, but then you've got the races for the like the Ferguson, which is 2-year-olds, 2-year-old fillies on the dirt. You've got the Louisiana bred, I think, are both other stakes on the grass? No, one is on the other two are on the dirt. So you got three stakes, Louisiana breds, and then a Louisiana bred maiden special on the 9-race card. So they're all full fields, more or less. So, you know, 14, here's a 14 horse. The Ferguson's 14. The maiden special 12 with four AEs. The A-Bear is got 11. The nine as well in the other stakes. So Louisiana Bred's helping fill out the cards.
Yeah, early on in the meet, obviously a lot of our horsemen still up here in Kentucky. So it's Louisiana Bred heavy. And to your point, all of these stakes races perfectly align as preps for Champions Day, which is the second Saturday of December. So this gives these horses an opportunity to get a trip over the track and prep for that big day for the Louisiana Breds. And you're exactly right. The Louisiana Bred program is, one of the stronger breed incentive programs around. It offers a number of opportunities throughout the meet to compete in stakes company. It's definitely a Louisiana flair when we get open early down there and have the ability to offer some preps for the big day for the Louisiana Breds. So you'll definitely see that. But I think there's a pretty high quality open 2-year-old grass race down there. I saw Mark Cassie had a couple horses in it and the usual suspects. So while the stakes action is pretty keen to the Louisiana Breds, there's a sprinkle of what's to come there from the open horse side as well.
And I'm just trying to pull up the stakes calendar, and there we go, horseman information, because I want to give everybody the weekends so that they can.
Yeah, I got them right here.
You got them? Go ahead, pull them out if you don't mind.
Hang on. So the first Dirt Road to the Derby prep series is December 23rd. It's that Santa Super Saturday card that we offer the Gun Runner and the first Road to the Derby series there. I am doing the same thing you're doing.
I got it now. Yeah, took me a minute. Kickoff, yeah, December 23rd is the kickoff. With the Tenacious, the Richie Shearer, the Blushing KD, the Gun Runner, the Untappable, the Buddy DiLiberto, and the Sugar Bowl and the Letelier. Then we come back with January 20th is LeCompte and Silver Bullet Day, plus the turf races and the Krantz and the Colonel Bradley, etc. My favorite and the one I usually get to is Derby Preview Day, of course, Risen Star, Rachel Alexandra, the Mineshaft, the Fairgrounds, etc. And then Louisiana, that's February 17th. And then March 23rd, Louisiana Derby Day itself. And take your pick, folks, because you can't go wrong.
Yeah, no, you're right. You come on the good one. That Risen Star card traditionally falls around Mardi Gras, which is excitement in the city. And that weekend with the Rachel Alexandra has been a phenomenal Kentucky Oaks prep race. And then over the last few years, the Risen Star, has been a true key Kentucky Derby stepping stone. So you definitely, as a seasoned veteran, would know the time to come for sure.
Well, and the funny thing is, after many years of Risen Star visits, where it was either the weekend before Mardi Gras or the weekend after, I finally hit it. It was last year or 2 years ago when, and I really was in the teeth. This year again, though, it is right on top. And the Mardi Gras stake itself, Fat Tuesday, is February 13th. So yep. Then the 17th. So for those that are booking, if you're, and I'm glad I looked at this, Gary, for those that are thinking about it, you better get in front of it because the hotels are impossible, and you better make your move.
It's a little better this year. To your point, last year the Risen Star was the Saturday prior to Mardi Gras Day, that was the ultimate daily double there.
Yeah.
So you've got a chance to have a little bit of a, I think about the Grant Foresters of the world. They'll be able to recover from Mardi Gras Day to Risen Star Day, at least.
Pretty good. And the city will, the city will almost be cleaned up by Saturday.
Almost. But no, look, really exciting meet coming up. Eager to get going. Eager to see some new faces down there and our old stalwarts. And I think it's going to be, I've got a lot of anticipation for what's to come down there.
Well, and of course, we got Kevin Kilroy, and we've got Joe Christofek will be down there as soon as Churchill wraps up. Just looking also at this calendar, the race for your dad is January 6th.
Yep, we'll be there.
Along with Nellie Menard and the Bob Wright, as I've said before, that's quite a trifecta. And no venue pays tribute to the contributors and the legends on the scene like they do at Fairgrounds. Gary, let's also take the opportunity to look ahead to Turfway, which the anticipation, we talked about this last year, too, with the building finished and, with the purses brimming. There's plenty of horsemen and owners that are staying home. And we'll be operating through the winter at Turfway.
No, spot on. Turfway should maintain similar purse levels to where we were at last year. Similar to Fairgrounds, we've got some fresh faces that'll be on the Turfway scene this year, including Tom Amos will have a division up there. Josie Carroll will have a Turfway contingent of Woodbine horses, traditional synthetic type horses. Phil D'Amato is going to keep a Kentucky division here year round. Wow. He will have a string at Turfway. Kelsey Danner will be a key player. Cherie DeVoe, just to name a few of the new trainers we'll have there. From a riding colony perspective, a number of new faces as well. Gerardo Corrales will sort of be the front runner for leading rider there, but Adam Basquitza stays home this year at Turfway. Abel Cedillo comes over from California. You've got Tyler Connor and a couple of folks coming down for Presque Isle. So a number of new horsemen, both trainers and jockeys. And obviously, as a horse player myself, I get fired up for the multi-race exotics at Turfway that on any given night, are just bonanza, five figure payouts. So we're gonna run 9 races a day there as long as we can continue to maintain those field sizes, which will allow for 2 pick fives, 2 pick fours, and plenty of chances to score. So from a horse player perspective, Turfway is a really fun puzzle. You've got horses trying synthetic for the first time. You've got trainers there that for the first time. It's on any given night, $30,000 or $40,000 pick five payout is absolutely possible if you can connect the dots.
Well, we should also mention some of the key dates as well. If you've never been for the Jeff Ruby and for the Bourbon at Oaks, one of my favorite named races, and the Kentucky Cup Classic, of course, March 23rd is the date for this year's Jeff Ruby, which is now up to $700,000 and is also in terms of points for Derby and Oaks, right? Between the Trophy and the Battaglia, they're getting points as well leading into the Ruby and the Bourbonette.
Yeah, sneaky Kentucky Derby performances out of the Jeff Ruby. You had two fills last year. Yep. It was the Ruby winner, and then the year before you had Rich Strike coming out of the Ruby to show up huge on Derby Day. So another race that over the last 2 or 3 years has shown up on the first Saturday in May.
Well, we're going to hope to show up, and I think Martin, haven't been for probably 5 years for the Ruby, and I'm just I'm going to think that this could pay off. This could really work out because it's the week. I think it's the week after Vegas, so I think after we come out of the NHC, we can make our way to the tri-state area.
Let's do it. Come on down to Florence, y'all.
Florence, y'all is right. as somebody who lived in Cincinnati as a P&G food service marketing division manager, and I love coming back to the Natty. So I will make every effort to make that happen.
All right. Yeah, I know that sounds good. And again, those Ruby and Louisiana Derby are fall on the same day, so we'll ping pong back and forth with post times and make sure that there's some creative stuff going on between the two properties.
Oh,
that's a fun day for us.
So maybe a cross a promotional. Did we do that last year? Did we have a?
We did.
That's
yep,
right.
We
that's
did.
Right.
So yeah, so it'll be another opportunity to do some stuff like that and really kind of try to have both of those big days fully on display.
Well, we're looking forward to handicapping them and getting regular visits in. Who's handling all the on air stuff at Turfway?
Got Caitlin Free, and I think Schapp will make some appearances.
Nice.
And Kevin Kirstein handling the media side with all of his communications. And speaking of communications, you know, one of the things we pushed out last week was the partnership with Claiborne Farm,
yep.
which I thought was pretty cool. The Make Your Mayor series, where there's three Philly and Mayor stakes in the early part or December and January time period. You know, what we see around here is there's a number of racing and broodmare prospects that are sold, you know, last week and this week here in Lexington. And, you know, the opportunity for those horses to try to get a little more black type before they hit the breeding shed next spring, and a great partnership with Claiborne, who's going to provide credits to their stallions. So if you come over to Turfway and you hit the board, run 1, 2, or 3 in a couple of those stakes races that are part of that Make Your Mayor series, Claiborne will give $10,000 to the winner, $5,000 to second, and $2,500 to third as a credit toward any of their stallions for next season. So a nice opportunity for a mayor to pick up a little black type and potentially get a little discount on a quality Claiborne sire.
Very cool. And I am going to try to get Walker in advance of that, too, to talk about it. A nice concept. Now, Gary, busy winter is ahead, and still got a few weeks at Churchill, including Stars of Tomorrow, too, which we look forward to after Thanksgiving. I will wish you and the family the happiest of Thanksgivings. And we'll see you. We'll see you on the road, and talk soon.
All right, and I hope you get to see Taylor over there at the Eagles game this week. I know you'll be looking for
it. I love it. She better, you know, as she's got a problem. She's got as much of a problem as the Kelsey mother, because she's from the Philadelphia area and grew up an Eagles fan, and now she's involved, which it's a mess. And both communities, nobody's even concerned about the outcome of the Super Bowl rematch. They're worried about what she's going to wear, whether she's going to wear an Eagles jersey or it's a mess. It's very funny.
That's awesome. Good deal. Well, thank you for that. And we'll catch up soon. Have a great holiday.
Thanks, Gary. Gary Palmisano Jr., everybody. G-Pal, the Prince. We're going to take our only break. Let's slip out. And when we come back, I got to get to Tony, but I've also got Joe Clancy. We got Dave Hill. We've got Celebrity Chef. I think he likes it when I call him Celebrity Chef. Neil Kleinberg will join us to close out the morning, and we'll do our annual Thanksgiving meal tips and ideas and suggestions. Every year we kind of come up with one or two interesting nuances, and we'll see what's new in the world of turkey preparation. I'm going to do something different, and we'll see what Neil thinks of it. I haven't told him the specifics, so we'll see what he's got for us. At the Races, second half on this busy Thursday, Sirius XM, back after this.